So this is part two of chapter 20, the Federal Reserve Wrecks America. And actually, the next class is going to be part three, because I felt like this chapter was so important. And Stephen had so many little points to make along the way that I just felt like I didn't want to rush through it, you know. And it's a pretty important piece of history to our country and to the world, actually. So here we have part two, and representative in the U.S. Congress, Lewis McFadden, on the lower left, his quote is, "He felt that it was not accidental, it was a carefully contrived occurrence. The international bankers sought to bring about a condition of despair here so that they might emerge as rulers of us all." And we're going to talk about Lewis McFadden in part three, but he actually brought articles of impeachment against the Federal Reserve Board and the Department of the Treasury and other, while he was in Congress. He was so upset by what was happening with the country, with the Federal Reserve.
And how did it go? They refused to hear him because...
Say it louder for more.
Did they refuse to hear him because it wasn't a federal agency?
No, they heard it, but the Congress wouldn't execute it. They wouldn't bring it out on the floor for discussion or anything.
Wow.
Yeah. And this is the state of the United States and a lot of the world, actually, during the Great Depression of the 1930s. These are very typical pictures, unfortunately.
So Europe was like this too, not just us.
Oh yeah, because Europe was on the gold standard, just like us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and England. Yeah. Yeah. The only country that wasn't really effective was China, because it was on the silver standard. So, domestically, it just used silver, and that was it. Okay, so, whoops, okay.
That was good.
Cui bono? How do you say that?
Cui bono.
Cui bono. What's that mean?
Who benefits?
Who benefits, thanks. So, I would keep that in the back of the mind. Stephen?
It's Italian. It's not Spanish or Portuguese.
It's what is
Italian?
It?
Latin?
Italian.
It's Italian. Ah,
maybe
okay.
It's a Latin, but I don't know. Latin, not that well. I think it's Italian.
It looks Latin to me. Cui bono.
Well, they are very similar.
Q-U-I would be more like Latin.
Yeah.
Q-U-E, I don't know.
Stephen doesn't analyze the chapter, doesn't analyze this piece of history in terms of who benefits, who let this happen. He strictly looks at it from what is the monetary system, who controls it, who controls the money, and why are things happening. But I put this in because I think it's important to think about it, ultimately.
Yeah.
Who has the control?
Whenever there's a problem, you have to say who is benefiting from this.
And also, when you see the extent of the damage to people in the society, it makes you even feel more that you have to know the people who are going to be making decisions. I mean, they have some power over everybody's life. Okay. And who knew the monetary system and let it happen? Okay. Because most people don't know the monetary system. It's not taught. Okay. Don, you want to read the...
Themes of the Lost Science of Money book. 1. Primary importance of the money power, that's the power to create money and regulate it. 2. The nature of money purposely kept secret and confused. 3. How a society defines money determines who controls the society. 4. The battle over control of money has raged for millennia. That battle is the public against the private. 5. The misuse of the monetary system causes tremendous misery and suffering for the ordinary people, say Will Decker and Martin Dunn in February of last year. Six, whenever the public has owned a significant fraction of the money power, great public benefit has ensued. Sparta, the Roman Republic, the American colonies in the 18th century, greenbacks after the Civil War, Canada after the Great Depression, British experience after World War II, says Martin Dunn, July 2014. He's the man that answered the Skype.
He's Skype.
That's you!
Hi.
I was like, who's Martin?
Martin and Will are out in Oklahoma.
I'm talking to a famous person. I had no idea.
If you come out with some thoughtful things, quotes
cool.
or something,
you'll be on the internet. So this is the parts of this chapter. First, we're going to look at the depression, the actual crash of the stock market. Then after that, the bank failures, where the money supply plunges. And then Britain forced to abandon its gold standard. And then looking at some of the descriptions of the depression. And then second part is some reactions to this, all of this happening. We're going to talk about the bankers that didn't help end the depression at all, the silent economists who weren't helpful, some congressmen understood, we'll look at that, some economists understood, we'll look at that, and the pushing on a string argument that bankers used not to do anything, and following Adam Smith through the doors of hell, which is the free market argument, which also gave excuse to not to do anything while the country and the people were falling apart. And then the third banking crisis, when Roosevelt closes the banks, which is very dramatic.
He called it a holiday.
Yes. Say it louder.
Called it a holiday.
Right. And then Keynes to the rescue. Keynes was an English economist, very, very famous. And he wrote a letter to Roosevelt that was published in the New York Times and at the the end of 1933, and talk about the solutions that Keynes offered and what we think about them. And then we're going to look at the financial losses, which is the real wreckage of these years from 1930 to World War II. The New Deal, we'll look at some of the things that Roosevelt did and how he funded them. And then we're going to talk about how the farmers were caught in the debt trap and some of the credit that was offered by the New Deal to the farmers. I never want to forget the farmers when we're talking about the economy. And then the point that at least the government acted because the banking system was not. And why monetary power should always reside with the government and not with private parties. And then another greenback is needed, an alternative plan that was presented during the 1930s by some economists and actually was re-presented recently by an economist. Okay, so that's basically what we're going to cover. Okay. So Anne, why don't you do the first one?
The depression, the crash. Stocks reached their peak on September 7th, 1929, and the decline in the following 4 weeks was orderly and produced no panic. The decline then degenerated into a panic. On October 24th, Black Thursday, a record 12,894,650 shares were traded. On Black Monday, October 28th, the market went into freefall. Black Monday was followed by Black Tuesday, October 29th, in which stock prices collapsed completely and 16,410,030 shares were traded on the New York Stock Exchange in a single day. Billions of dollars were lost, wiping out thousands of investors. Now the great, we have the chart, the great stock market crash of 1929, and there's Black Tuesday.
Right up there.
Way up there. And the market low all the way down, 1932.
It just went down
and down and down.
After 33, when everybody realized I'd just been born.
Don's here.
So they got more confident and it went up again.
Oh, how nice. I'm glad you were born.
Yeah, this is quite a drama here.
So when you're saying that there's like, because I mean, for me to understand this a little bit better, I don't understand it too well. But for, so you have 13 million to 16 million shares traded over a period of 4 or 5 days.
On one day. This was on Thursday.
From Thursday to Monday, right?
No, on one day. This Thursday.
We're almost 13 million.
And then
on Monday,
the following Tuesday,
complete collapse.
Okay, so those, the difference between that stock market and the stock market that came into being is that those were more like, those weren't only the wealthy that were trading, it was more general public, like people. Like, why is it that if we're talking about this in a context of the elite kind of getting the control of the stock market? Or, like, there's an idea here that you presented that they did it on purpose, right?
Well, don't worry about that.
Okay. All right.
Don't worry about anybody pulling
the strings.
Okay. This is something that happened that wiped out everybody in the stock market, whoever had
shares.
Yeah.
Okay.
And at that time in the 1920s, with the stock market bubble, banks were selling to their depositors.
Selling stocks.
Everybody had stock.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, everybody was encouraged
to invest
in stocks like crazy. And then they were also encouraged to buy stocks on margin, which means on credit.
Yeah.
Well, the market is going up and up and up, and you might not have the money to buy. Well, hey, we'll give you credit. We'll give you a loan. Yeah. So this whole thing goes up and it's all...
Kind of like what they did with the housing recently.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then the whole thing crashes and there you are with all this debt. So
the people in the know got out. I mean, there's always the people in the know, you know, who say, I know that this can't be really true value, blah, 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 blah. But this... there were banks, many banks, and a lot of Wall Street banks in the 20s that when they had manipulated the law enough that they had their own securities companies. And you would come into National City Bank to make a deposit, and there'd be a man sitting there selling stocks. That's how it was. In the 1920s. Oh, yeah.
Ubiquitous. They were everywhere.
Yeah.
Freewheeling.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Kennedy sold out early and became rich.
Yes, he did.
Yeah, he's one of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay, so this is...
The crash.
The crash. Linnea, why don't you read this one?
Okay. The Depression, the Crash. The crash made clear to virtually everyone that capitalism, to the extent it was defined by the American political, economic, and market system, had fundamentally failed. That is the history we have been in the process of unlearning. It is a history that we appear doomed to repeat once more, says Zarlenga, page 548. Capitalism is also a monetary system. It is the debt money system.
And this is the point that this book is all about, that there is a money system that is basic and foundational to any society. And if the public isn't educated in it, it can be manipulated. So we're not educated in our money system. We're not taught about money, you know. So if you ask most people in the United States, where does our money come from? They say the government, which is, it doesn't come from our government. It's not true. But that's what is sort of, and if you say this to every, if you say, when a bank makes a loan, where do they get the money? They say, well, they get the money from some depositor's money, and they give the money, they lend the money to you. And that's not true. So, we're just not taught the truth, you know.
And I went on a trip with my family to Washington when I was a little kid, and we went to the Bureau of Printing and Engraving, where they print all the printed money. So I knew that the government made the money.
Right, right. Of course.
It's a tiny percentage now.
Yes.
Somewhere, even after the Second World War, the paper money was about 20% of the money in circulation.
And now it's even less, right?
Yeah, it's about 2%, maybe 3%.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's another point, too. Zarlinga wrote this, what, around 2002, something like that. I think that's when The Lost Science of Money was published, in the early 2000s. And it's really interesting to read what he says in light of what has happened since this book was published.
Right.
It's incredibly prescient.
Yes. Mm. Because he knows the money system and the history, you know. I think the point here is that we've forgotten this history about the Great Depression, and we're more bubbles, right? Up and down. Here's a picture outside the New York Stock Exchange.
Yeah.
$100 will buy this car. Must have cash, lost all on the stock market.
Yeah.
And this is the stock market. In the other picture, the stock market is on the left. It's this building here on the left. And Wall Street is in front of the building in the center.
What's the name of that building?
Federal Hall.
Federal.
Yeah, yeah.
That's George Washington's statue.
Yeah, that's George.
That's where he, gave his last address to the troops, his farewell address?
Uh-huh.
Huh. That's an old building.
Yes, it is.
Don, do the next one.
The crash. The crash left no mark on currency held by the public. Its direct financial effect was confined to the stock market and did not arouse any distrust of banks by their depositors. It changed the atmosphere within which businessmen and others were making their plans and spread uncertainty. It decreased the amount they desired to spend on goods and services. It increased the amount they wanted to add to their money balances.
So the business got terrified, right? This is, nothing had ever happened like this before. A lot of them lost money, lost their investments in the stock market.
Look at the graph. Down, everything's going down. The top is the personal income going down. Production's going down parallel to the personal income. And wholesale prices almost as fast.
Now, what's the years here?
29 to 33.
Okay. Now notice, the thing about this is notice in 1929, when this is the stock market crash, this line,
mm-hmm.
Okay? And this is the first banking crisis, right? Because the stock market crashes, but everyone's still walking around with the cash in there. Thing. So they're not worried about the banks.
Right.
You know, they're worried if they had stock invested.
If they lost money on stocks, then they're worried.
Right.
If they didn't, then they're not worried.
Right. So here, if you see, but because the businessmen are all terrified, right, and maybe they're not going to invest as much as they did, wait a minute, let's wait to see what happens, you know. And so their industrial production is going down. So the economy is slowly shrinking because everyone is terrified.
And they're not loaning. And people don't really want to take loans, probably.
Let's learn about the banks.
Right.
When you say loaning, we're talking about the banks. But this isn't talking just about businessmen making decisions, right? Okay. I'll do this one. The money supply plunges. Throughout their analysis, Friedman and Swartz, and they wrote a book, The Economic History of the United States, 1867 to 1960. It was published, I think, around 1964. So Friedman and Swartz divided the money stock of banks into two major components. So this is inside a bank, you have currency, like Federal Reserve notes, gold and silver coins, and you have deposits, like people's checking accounts, right? And they said, from the cyclical peak in August 1929, that's the top of the bubble, right, to the cyclical trough, is it? That's
trough.
Okay, trough in March 1933, the stock of money fell by over one-third. So there's one-third less deposits and cash for people to live on.
Because banks,
same population, same economy, one-third. It's an incredible, incredible amount.
What made it decline?
The banking crises, and we'll see. So, here's the money stock. The money stock is in a bank. It's talking about the bank. The cash in the bank and the deposits of the depositors. So that's the money stock. So that's going down. The demand deposits are going down because people are going running into the bank to get their money out. They got, right after the crash, they didn't get panicked about it. But as the businessmen got scared, and as the economy started to shrink, and as people started laying off, people got nervous. I make sure I have my money, right? And this is currency held by the public. Look at the way it's going.
Yeah, they kept it under the mattress.
They're going to the bank and getting their gold and silver and their Federal Reserve notes, and they're not leaving them in the bank because they're scared. And this is from 1929 to 1933. 1933 is on the Roosevelt.
So both currency and deposits are going down.
Well, it's the deposits in the bank are going down, and this is the money stock, which are deposits and cash in the bank. So the money stock is what's in the bank. This is what's in the currency.
Yeah, I understood that for a bit.
Yeah.
Because the fact that they divided them into currency and deposits for the purpose of the graph, is that related?
Say that again?
The fact that Friedman and Swartz are dividing currency versus deposits held by the banks, is that important to the graph? Are they related?
Well, they don't have the currency held by the bank. They have the demand deposits here.
Okay.
And this is both.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. But this is the public, and this is the bank.
Yeah, no, I got that.
Yeah. Okay. Martin, why don't you do the next one?
Okay. Okay, the money supply plunges. The really crucial data, the money supply figures, were not being watched at the time. In fact, the figures were not being published in a timely way and were not readily available. That's Stephen Zelenger, Lost Science of Money, page 548. The contraction, this is Friedman and Swartz. The contraction is, in fact, a tragic testimonial to the importance of monetary forces. It is hardly conceivable that money income could have declined by over one half and prices by over one third in the course of 4 years if there had been no decline in the stock of money, i.e. money. The money stock is critical here.
Absolutely.
And over there on the right, it looks as though we have a family that is living in a tent and people don't look happy.
What's the baby eating?
Looks like he's in dirt.
Looks like dirt.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Ian, why don't you do this one?
The first banking crisis, October 1930.
So this is a year later. A year later.
In October 1930, the monetary character of the contraction changed dramatically. A crop of bank failures particularly in Missouri, Indiana, Illinois, Iowa, Arkansas, and North Carolina,
all in the Midwest,
led to widespread attempts to convert demand and time deposits into currency, and also, to a much lesser extent, into postal savings deposits. A contagion of fear spread among depositors, starting from the agricultural areas, which had experienced the heaviest impact of bank failures in the 20s. But such contagion knows no geographical limits, Friedman and Swartz. I don't understand what's meant by that, the second, you know, led to widespread attempts to convert demand and time deposits into currency and postal savings. I don't know what's meant by that.
These people here who are the depositors are running into the bank to get cash.
Yeah.
So they're...
currency.
They're
currency.
Yeah. Isn't that the same?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
And to a much lesser extent, into postal savings deposits. In other words, they wanted to get stamps?
No, no, they had deposit accounts in the postal service.
So was like a separate banking system?
I never heard of that.
Yeah, just for deposits. They didn't make loans or anything, just for deposits.
Okay.
So they put, some people put it there for safekeeping.
Uh-huh.
But a lot of them, like Don said, took them home.
Yeah.
So kind of...
In other words, we're talking about bank runs here.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Which we had one in 2008. We had a number of them, right? Well, we had one in Britain. What was the one in Britain in 2008?
Northern Rock.
Right. People were standing outside.
Waiting. Yeah, I mean, it was a classic bank run. And Northern Rock was a fairly large bank.
Yeah. And then what is that little island in the Mediterranean?
Malta?
You mean
they had
Cyprus?
People, that was wasn't that a bank run, Cyprus?
They had bank runs there, yes.
Yeah. So, remember back then, there was no FDIC insurance. So if you had your money in the bank, and the bank went belly up...
You got nothing.
Yeah. Probably did.
After this,
Yeah. Linnea, do the next one.
Okay. The Depression money supply plunges. The first bank failures in October of 1930. Currency held by the public stopped declining and started to rise. Friedman and Schwartz said this. The failure of 256 banks with $180 million of deposits in November of 1930 was followed by the failure of 352 with over $370 million worth of deposits in December, the most dramatic being the failure on December 11th of the Bank of the U.S. with over $200 million of deposits. The Bank of the U.S. was the largest deposit failure in the U.S. history up to that time. In addition, its name led many to regard it as an official bank, which it was not, and was a further blow to confidence. It was a member of the Federal Reserve System. The clearinghouse banks failed to support a plan devised by the New York Federal Bank to reorganize it and save its depositors.
They let it fail. This is here's the bank that you can see. And it sounds very official. It was just an ordinary bank. But here are all the people. The line goes around the corner.
Yeah.
God. What a time, huh?
Well, a lot of people were moving their money, I don't know necessarily under the mattress back in 2007-8, but moving it around so that they wouldn't, so that their accounts would be covered by the FDIC.
Yeah.
You know, if you had too much money, then you move some of it out, put it in another bank, and move it all around.
Yeah.
And or I move my money to TD Bank, which is probably not. I thought a Canadian bank might be safer than an American bank.
But TD Bank is now one of the 21 primary dealers of the New York Federal Reserve. You know, it's up there with the Wall Street banks.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. It's the elite, the 21 dealers of the Federal Reserve Bank, securities dealers.
Yeah. Can't trust those Canadians.
Linnea, why don't you do this one?
I just did one. I think it's Dad's turn.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
You can't keep track.
Money supply plunges. The first bank failures, October 1930. No help from the big banks. For 2.5 months before its closing, Joseph A. Broderick, New York State Superintendent of Banks, had sponsored various merger plans, which would have saved the bank. The decision of the clearinghouse banks not to save the Bank of the United States was reached at a meeting held at the New York Fed Bank and was not changed despite personal appeals by Broderick and New York State Lieutenant Governor Herbert H. Lehman. Broderick's account of his statement of the bankers follows in part. I said it, that basically the Bank of the United States had thousands of borrowers that had financed small merchants, especially Jewish merchants, and that its closing might and probably would result in widespread bankruptcy among those it served. I warned that its closing would result in the closing of at least 10 other banks in the city, and that it might even affect the savings banks. The influence of the closing might even extend outside the city, I told them. I reminded them that only 2 or 3 weeks before, they had rescued 2 of the largest private banks of the city and had willingly put up the money needed. I asked them if their decision to drop the plan was still final. They told me it was. Then I warned them that they were making the most colossal mistake in the banking history of New York. Annual Report of Superintendent of Banks, State of New York, Part 1, December 31, 1930. And a picture of the Essex Street Market, that's way downtown. Sometimes.
Yeah, these are the, I put that in because that's where the Jewish merchants are, and the East Side.
It's a little Italy, I think. I don't know for sure.
Back then, it was Jewish.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And actually, all of that has moved away. The Jewish merchants down there are gone.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's Hispanic.
Uh-huh.
Huh. So here you see the big banks not willing to save the smaller banks. Yeah. And people's lives depending on it. I'll do this one. The first bank failure is October 1930.
Is there a mistake in spelling and coverting?
Converting.
Converting.
I could change that. I'll do that later. Okay. Under the pre-Federal Reserve banking system, the final months of 1930 would probably have seen a restriction of convertibility, converting deposits into currency. The banks would have turned to the people coming in to pull the money out and said, we're not giving any cash out, but you can make checks and use your checks to make transactions, but we're not giving cash out. So, you know, that would be pre-1914,
mm-hmm.
Okay? Restriction would almost certainly have prevented the subsequent waves of bank failures that were destined to come in 1931, 32, and 33. Just as restriction in 1893 and 1907 had quickly ended bank suspensions arising primarily from lack of liquidity. And lack of liquidity is that there's not enough cash in the bank to give it to all the depositors who come in. It's not that the bank doesn't have it somewhere,
uh-huh.
You know, but they don't have it in the moment. So there was no restriction on converting deposit. Nothing was put in place for that.
So before 1914, there had been something?
Yes, that's what they would do. They would, the banking system before the Federal Reserve would say, okay, no more, you can't get any more cash out. You can keep using your deposits, but no more cash. And that would stop the panic.
Yeah.
Yeah. know, one thing that was stopped.
1914 was the Federal Reserve.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And this is a quote. What I just read was from Friedman and Swartz. And this is a picture of a run on the Erie National Bank in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And it says, during the early years of the Great Depression, runs on deposits forced hundreds of banks throughout Pennsylvania to liquidate their affairs and close their doors. Allentown lost 6 of its 10 banks. And comes from Allentown.
I didn't know this.
Yes. And in Philadelphia, more than 50 banks, most of them small, also failed, taking with them all of their depositors' savings.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh,
I know. Well, look what, this is why so awful we're not taught about the monetary system. Yeah. Okay. Martin, do the next one.
He's there, but Martin? Hello, Martin?
We don't hear you.
Sorry, I'm a bit muted.
Oh.
Okay. The first bank failure is October 1930. Banks outside the system face liquidity crises. No access to Fed discount window.
Stop right there. Martin, stop right there. Okay. So what's the discount window? Does anyone remember?
That's where they make money. That's where they create money.
Money is created, but how? Okay. So each Federal Reserve Bank, there are 12 of them, has legally what's called a discount window, which means any of the member banks, if they get into trouble, they can take their securities that they have on their balance sheet, you know, like government securities, whatever, and they can take it to their Federal Reserve Bank and say, give me a loan. I need the money. My depositors are coming. Give me a loan. That's the discount window.
Okay.
If you were outside the Federal Reserve System, you didn't have that option to go and get a loan and save your bank.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is what is happening here. Yeah, you see, there were a lot of banks, small banks, not a lot of big ones, but a lot of small banks that were outside the Federal Reserve System at the time.
You can't tell you said the system, but not the Fed. You can say what kind of system it was.
Okay. I can add Federal Reserve.
Yeah, Fed.
Isn't it hard? Great. See, now you knew what I had to deal with growing up. Corrections all the time.
Yes.
Constant correction.
Yes. Well, he went to school with the Jesuits.
Yes.
And the Jesuits would, if you're very precise, if it's not exactly the right.
Yeah. I know.
It's not right at all.
Okay, continuing. Hang on just a second. Okay, the existence of the reserve system prevented concerted restriction. By reducing the concern of stronger banks, since the system provided them with an escape mechanism in the form of a discounting, i.e. borrowing from the Fed bank, and by supporting the general assumption that such a move was made unnecessary by the establishment of the system. That's Friedman and Schwartz, page 311. And here we're looking at, I believe, the St. Petersburg, Florida, in 1931, there was panic in the streets and a real live run on a bank, the Central National Bank and Trust, and it is no more.
Right. I think I should make this this wording a little more English. The existence of the Federal Reserve System prevented the restriction of turning deposits into cash, right? The stronger banks had access to this borrowing at their Federal Reserve window.
Mm-hmm.
So they weren't concerned, you know, okay, there's a bank run down the street, but I can always go to my Federal Reserve and get money. So it was like, okay, that bank can fail. I'm not going to fail. So the way the system was working at the time was conducive to letting smaller banks fail, you know. Linnea. Oh, is it Anne? I am. Sorry.
I'm so fair. I'm like, no, it's not my church.
The second banking crisis, March 1931. The public resumed withdrawing cash. From March on, the public resumed converting deposits into currency, and from April on, banks started liquidating available assets in order to meet both the public's demand for currency and their own desire for liquidity. Currency was being withdrawn internally by depositors, justifiably fearful for the safety of banks, and gold was being withdrawn externally by foreigners, fearful for the maintenance of the gold standard. That's Riemann and Schwartz. Bank money stock plummeted, bank currency and deposits down. As the stock of money declined, the price of goods necessarily followed. Deflation caused bankruptcies, unemployment, hunger, and human misery.
Right. So as the stock of money declined, as the deposits in the bank disappeared, because people came in and pulled out their cash.
Word stock shouldn't be there. Should use a different word.
Yeah. What's a good word?
As the amount of money.
Inventory.
As the amount?
Yes.
Okay.
The stock, now we're thinking we're in the stock market.
Right. Yeah. Very good, yeah. Okay. March 1931. Right. So as the amount of money declined overall, and just for Linnea, I'll just say.
I mean, I understand these concepts, but yeah.
Oh, from your dad?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
Okay.
But yeah, go ahead, please. Okay. If you feel like, you want to clarify something.
Well, just that if there is X amount of deposits in a bank, and then the bank fails, that means there's X amount of less money in the overall society.
Mm-hmm.
It's gone.
Right, because the bank is failing at taking that.
Yeah. Deposits, the cash is still there, but it's going to be used to pay off whatever little debts it can. But the deposits, which the bank had created when they had made loans, that
suddenly... Also, they sold their assets.
The banks would sell their assets in an attempt to get cash to give to their depositors.
Yeah.
Right. But then, if all these banks are having trouble, and they're all suddenly selling their securities to get cash because of their depositors having all these runs on them, then what's going to happen to the price of the securities? It's going to suddenly flooded with this huge amount of securities. So the price of the securities goes down. So now it's even harder for the banks to raise enough cash. It's a cycle, a cycle. And that's what this is talking about. As the money supply got less and less, remember overall it went down a third, the economy was shrinking, and therefore the prices of things were going down. Now, whenever the price of something goes down, it makes it harder for the producer to make a profit, so he's going to lay off people, and he might even go bankrupt.
That's right.
So it's a cycle. This goes down and down and down, and it starts with the money supply shrinking, which should never happen.
Mm-hmm.
The Federal Reserve System is supposed to be the system of last resort. It's the one to create the reserves for the banks and for the banks to create the money for the economy, for the people to live on. It should never happen that it should shrink a third like this. You'll see why it happened.
So, I'm sorry, actually, now I feel like I have to admit ignorance. Where did securities come from? Like, what is that? What's a security and annuity?
Well, there's a stock and a bond.
Right.
Now, a stock is... a corporation coming together and saying, do you want to buy a piece of us?
A share. Mm-hmm.
So it's a piece of paper that says...
That you have your investor in that company.
Right.
Right.
Now...
I'm the owner.
Is that what a security is? Same thing?
That's one type of security.
Oh, okay.
Then the other major type is a bond, which is...
Okay. Right.
Which is a corporation saying, I need money, will you loan it to me? And they give you a piece of paper with interest.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah. And the banks, all banks, will go out and buy stocks and bonds. and put them on their balance sheet. They don't keep everything. And when they, and this I just learned recently and just integrated it recently, is when a bank buys a stock or bond, it just creates the money as an accounting entry to buy that stock and bond. Mm-hmm. It's another way for them to create money.
Yeah. And they, the bank sells, has, sells stocks of itself. So you can buy stocks of Citibank. Mm-hmm. And but here the value of their stocks,
right.
No one was going to buy their stocks.
Right, and the value of the stocks that they owned of other corporations,
yeah.
Because they all were selling them to get cash to give to the depositors, they went down and down in price, and less then the banks did become insolvent, meaning they don't have enough money to pay their depositors, you know.
Yeah.
See, there's a difference between being insolvent. You know, you don't, the bank doesn't have enough money. If they sold all their stocks and bonds, they couldn't raise all the money they owed their depositors. That's an insolvent bank. But in a liquid bank, the depositors are running to the door and they want their deposits, and the bank has stocks and bonds, but it doesn't have time to sell them. So they try to calm the depositors and say, okay, give us time. And ultimately, if the market stays stable, they'll be able to sell their stocks and bonds and give their depositors their money.
Their money, yeah.
That's an illiquid bank, right? And what happened in the Great Depression was the banks might have been illiquid in the beginning, but because of the intensity of the bank runs and it's spreading around and the banks dumping their securities in order to raise cash, quickly they became insolvent, you know. So it's like the stock market, it's like a panic. Mm-hmm. So, and this panic in the banking system went on 1930, 1931, and 1933, and then you'll see it just was, there was, it was going to be a total collapse at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There were a lot of moves.
Who's next? Okay.
The Depression. Britain forced to abandon its gold standard folly. In September 21st of 1931, after runs on sterling precipitated by France and the Netherlands, Britain abandoned the gold standard. Even after the crash, up to mid-1931, the Fed continued to support the Bank of England's failing gold standard, extending loans to European banks while denying them to domestic industry. Then in mid-1931, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and other Federal Reserve banks were buying commercial paper from the Bank of England and the central banks of Austria, Hungary, and Germany, totaling $145 million. I'm not going to read the annotation. And then Britain's departure from gold had little effect on the continuous decline of the country at an annual rate of 31% decline in personal income, 32% for production, wow, that's a lot, 14% for wholesale prices. And then, I guess, Sue, you'll explain the graph.
Like, well, yeah, this is the personal income here on the top line. See how this is from 1929 to 1933, basically. And industrial production, everything's going down year after year, and the prices. And you have to remember, when the prices are going down, it just means the whole system is slowly unfolding, unraveling, because those prices are what the people who produce goods make their profits from.
Mm-hmm.
So as soon as the prices start going down, they start cutting staff, going bankrupt. That's the key, is to keep that price up, you know. And so this the point of this is the banks weren't loaning to American businesses, but the Federal Reserve banks are giving loans to all these European countries. And they're supposed to be our system, our banking system.
Why? Why did they do that?
Well, it's come up. It'll come up.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Don.
Hobos.
Oh, boy.
Look at them crawling all over
the
car.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, look at that, huh?
To support the family and decrease the financial burden, many teenagers left home and hopped onto freight trains. They were called hobos, and they said they ride the rails. They made shelters with cardboard boxes, branches, and abandoned stuffs. In the camp, they shared food and slept. Shacks were built near a town dump to make it easier to find food, clothes, and trash. They named themselves Hoovervilles because many people thought President Herbert Hoover didn't try hard enough to solve the economic difficulties.
Yeah. And you know, it's during one of the it's dangerous.
Yeah.
Being
go through a tunnel with a low ceiling in Dubai.
Oh yeah. Dangerous. The word tramp was first came into use.
Which one in, Chaplin, the tramp.
It came into use in one of the economic depressions of the 1800s. I think 1873. There was so much depression then, economic depression, that people were just walking around the roads trying to find, from one town to the other, trying to find jobs. And that's where the word tramp came from. And it's now they're hobos or tramps. And that's why they call them that.
Yeah, I think I told you the story about how my grandparents lived in a very nice upper middle class area, and they did well during the Depression because the kind of work my grandfather did was in no way related to what was going on in this mess. He was a consultant to the sugar industry in the Caribbean because he devised a method and patented it for refining sugar to where it's white. So he invented white sugar.
That's bad.
I know.
Everybody can do
that. It's his fault. So his passion in life is to remove every impurity.
Oh my God.
In the sugar. Well, anyhow. So he sold his patents to New Jersey Pipe and refinery company. And they hired him as his salesman in the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. So they would make the sugar mills, and he would go sell them. And he was fluent in French and Spanish, so mm-hmm. he went to Martinique, Puerto Rico, Cuba mainly, mm-hmm. and he sold all these sugar mills. And I have one of my niece's daughters was an engineer. When she was a student, they sent her on a volunteer trip with some other young engineers to Bolivia. And they looked at her last name, which is a funny last name, and they said, "Oh, we have that last name in the backyard." So they bring her back, and there's a sugar mill with my grandfather's name on it.
Oh, my goodness.
Bolivia.
Wow.
But anyway, then, so there's my grandmother, living with the family without her husband most of the time. And a man came to the door and he told her, he took out a gun and he put it to his head and he said, "I have glassware here and I want you to buy it from me for $100. And if you don't, I'm going to kill myself right here and now." And it was beautiful glassware, maybe six goblets. And she had a $100 bill in the Bible or something back in the library, and she took it out. It was an emergency, and she gave it to him. Huh. And then she took
He didn't shoot himself.
He didn't shoot himself.
For her.
She took the goblets and never used them, and they passed them to the family, and no one in the family ever used them either.
They weren't a drinking family.
Well, maybe also when you have that kind of attachment to it, like that story, I don't know if I'd want to use those goblets either.
I know. We were not a drinking family. They really weren't. I mean, when my grandparents had a cocktail party, it was little cocktails. It wasn't wine or beer or anything like that. Whiskey sours they made. They did make tulips of whiskey sours. Because they had sugar in them.
God, I wish my family drank a little bit.
But anyway, that was that was her story with the tramp.
Wow. Great Depression, huh? Wow. Poor people. Well, a lot of people are suffering today. Also, a lot of people. Because the system's the same. You know?
What do we have, 57 million people on food stamps?
Yeah.
Now?
Yeah, it's a lot.
I think I just...
I'm next, okay. Every major town and city had a Hooverville, which was a collection of huts and shacks housing the homeless. And this is from Hooverville in Central Ohio, 1938. And this is one in Seattle.
Yeah.
By 1932, one of every four workers was unemployed. Banks failed and life savings were lost, leaving many Americans destitute. With no job and no savings, thousands of Americans lost their homes. The poor congregated in cardboard shacks and so-called Hoovervilles on the edges of cities across the nation. Hundreds of thousands of the unemployed roamed the country on foot and in boxcars in futile search of jobs. Although few starved, hunger and malnutrition affected many. Yeah. It's really...
So 25% were unemployed. And you said today we have 20%.
57 million people on food stamps.
On food stamps.
That doesn't mean you're unemployed, though.
Okay,
no.
Yeah.
That means that you make less than like 11,000 or something.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry. All I know is the numbers.
This is pretty pathetic.
Fact.
Yeah. Martin, do the next one.
Okay. Hang on just a second. Right. Okay, looking around the world now. The collapse spread from the US to Europe and the rest of the world, except China, which was on a silver standard, not a gold standard, and was hardly affected. That's Stephen Zelenga, Lost Science of Money, page 548. I guess we're looking at Newfoundland.
Yes.
Poverty was common among Newfoundland and Labrador fishers during the Great Depression as prices for dried cod tumbled throughout the 1930s. Mm-hmm. Many became continuously indebted to merchants who loaned them gear, food, and other supplies on credit and took their catch as payment. Some fishers fell into such deep debt that merchants refused to give them any more supplies on credit. As the Great Depression deepened, many people in Newfoundland and Labrador became increasingly dissatisfied with government efforts to relieve poverty and unemployment. On the 5th of April 1932, a public demonstration outside the Colonial Building in St. John's escalated into a riot numbering 10,000 people. Prime Minister Sir Richard Squires escaped from the building with a police escort, but was voted out of office in an ensuing election. And looks like we have a riot outside the Colonial Building on the 5th of April 1932. And over there it looks like we've got a map of Canada with Newfoundland and Labrador. And those are obviously fisher folk.
Yeah.
Well, they could at least eat fish.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they didn't have to starve.
Although they had to get loans to get the gasoline or whatever to run the boats out there to where the fish were.
But again, the prices had gone so low, they can't make enough money to buy the food you need. You know?
Well, to get the fish,
right? Yeah, but you can't just eat fish. Anne, do the next one.
In the South, the Great Depression hit the South hard. A report by the federal government described the South during the Depression as a belt of sickness, misery, and unnecessary death. Out of 140,000 school children examined in 41 Carolina counties, 23,000 were malnourished. I don't have my glasses. During the Great Depression, Americans wondered how so many people could be hungry when the country's farmers were producing so much food. North Carolina's farmers were producing plenty of so-called cash crops, like cotton and tobacco, but they were not making enough money from these crops to afford food. Food was available and cash crops were being grown, but many people simply could not afford it. Between 1929 and 1932, the total amount that North Carolinians made from agriculture plummeted from $310.5 million to less than half that, $144.3 million. With too much cotton and tobacco and too little money to buy food, one government study reported that too many Southern families have simply done without, and as a result, they have suffered severely from malnutrition and dietary diseases. One of these diseases, pellagra, a devastating condition resulting from a chronic lack of niacin, vitamin B3. Pellagra caused a person's skin to crack and boil up in a similar fashion to leprosy, and victims eventually succumbed to dementia and death. The scourge of pellagra, wrote government officials, that affects the South almost exclusively as a dietary is a disease chiefly due to inadequate diet. It responds to rather simple preventative measure, including suitable nourishing food. Yeah, my mother, who is a nurse, told me that pellagra was common among people who ate mostly corn.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I had brunch with a guy, and he was talking about pellagra today.
Yeah. Yeah. Today.
Yeah.
Uh
huh. Yeah. Yeah. Linnea.
Okay. Reactions. The bankers didn't help end the depression. The Fed would not create reserves. The Fed was not set up to serve the nation. It was not really set up to serve the nation's monetary needs. The privately owned Fed was designed and set up to promote the short-term profits of the largest bankers while taking minimal risks. In the Great Depression, the bankers demonstrated they felt little or no responsibility towards the American people whose financial lives they controlled. Zerlinga,
That's why they're unconstitutional.
The system's holdings of government securities plus bills bought were nearly $200 million lower at the end of July 1930 than they were at the end of December 1929, Friedman and Schwartz.
Which means the system with the Federal Reserve System has they own government securities. If they wanted to get money out into the society, they would even buy more securities, creating the reserves or money, we'll say, and giving it to the society. Mm-hmm. And they wouldn't do that. They were holding on to what they had and just letting the banks fail, the system come apart. Mm. I mean, it's pretty incredible.
In other words, the banks were behaving the Federal Reserve was behaving just like the banks. They were simply not making loans, full stop.
Exactly, yes. They're not, at the Federal Reserve level, they're not creating reserves for their banks.
Right.
You know?
Mm-hmm. So even for the big banks?
Yeah. Yeah. This is the actual Federal Reserve System, which are the 12 banks, which are the banks for the commercial banks, right? And the Board of Directors, the Board of Governors, which was called the Federal Reserve Board back in the Depression. That's the board in Washington. That's not a bank, it's just a group of men. So between the two, and there are a couple of entities attached to the Federal Reserve Banks. It's called a Federal Advisory Council, which are made up of the bankers. They also give advice and their advice is, you know, they're bankers, they're giving advice, they're part of the Federal Reserve law. So there were all these bankers that were giving advice, but the system was doing nothing, you know. So that the last line, Martin, the last line was, want to read that?
Yeah, the Fed was not buying securities in the open market to create reserves.
Right. So the money supply was just getting lower and lower. more bankruptcies, more people unemployed, and they weren't doing anything. And I put this in, think of the consequences if you do nothing.
That's a plan. People would say they have no plan, but if you have no plan, that's a plan.
I don't know. Anne, do the next one.
The Fed would not create reserves. The Fed could not restore the public's confidence in a fractional reserve system. The board described its policy for the year 1930 as one of monetary ease. It seems paradoxical to describe as monetary ease a policy which permitted the stock of money to decline in 14 months by a percentage exceeded only four times in the preceding 54 years, and then only during extremely severe business cycle contractions.
Now, Stephen had said, if you remember a few slides back, that they weren't watching the money figures, which is hard to believe, but back then, the bankers and the bankers in the system, the majority of them, didn't think money supply, they thought credit strength. Well, how's the credit market, mm-hmm. you know? Just as to understand why they could do nothing, you know, they're not looking at this one-third decline mm-hmm. going on, you know. And they're also, like Stephen said, if they're members of the Federal Reserve System, they're looking at the non-member banks failing and saying, well, that's okay, I can always get a loan from my federal bank, Federal Reserve Bank. So all of this contributed to nothing being done, mm-hmm. you know. Linnea.
The bankers didn't help end the Depression again. The New York Fed Bank did not lead. Years of primary and direct responsibility for the conduct of monetary policy in the central money market of the country and of cooperation with men similarly placed in the other leading money markets of the world had developed in the technical personnel, officers, and directors of the New York Bank a profound awareness of monetary relations and a sensitive recognition of the effects of monetary policy actions.
See, they knew because they were making policy decisions all the way from the beginning of 1914, the New York Fed.
Those qualities were clearly absent at most other reserve banks, which had of necessity been concerned primarily with local and regional matters, or at the Federal Reserve Board, which had played only a minor role in the general conduct of policy, and it had no important operating functions. Friedman and Schwartz. At the time of the stock market crash, the New York Reserve Bank acted in the tradition of its earlier dominance, moving rapidly, decisively, and on its own. The adverse reaction of the board greatly inhibited further independent measures by New York.
So whatever the dynamic within the system between the New York Bank, the other reserve banks, the board in Washington, nobody did anything. Yeah. Makes me a little very scared, you know. You have to trust that people in these systems will, you know, be able to respond in emergencies.
They know something.
Yeah.
Well, we all went through these worries with the last crash and Bernanke and everybody tearing their hair.
And he, Bernanke, whoever he was talking to, ended up creating $16 trillion out of the Federal Reserve System to keep the world economy.
So he put money out there.
Short-term loan money, but $16
trillion. Yeah.
Now, back here, the money supply is $18 trillion, mm-hmm. right? Our money supply in this country. Back then, maybe the money supply was, I don't even know what the money supply in 1929 would have been. Maybe It wasn't even a trillion, that's for sure.
Think it'd be a trillion?
No, it's in the hundreds of billions of dollars.
Yeah.
You know. But still, they're not creating any reserve. The Federal Reserve Bank, banks and systems, they're not creating the reserves to keep the economy, you know, working so people have jobs and money and can eat, you know.
So the name is a complete misnomer. The New York Reserve Bank simply wasn't a reserve bank.
Right. No. The whole system. Whole system. Don.
Some reasons the federal bankers did nothing. One, Federal Reserve officials had no feeling of responsibility for non-member banks. Two, the bank failures were concentrated in smaller banks, and their disappearance were viewed with complacency by the big boys. Three, the relatively few large member banks that failed at the end of 1930 were regarded by many reserve officials as unfortunate cases of bad management, and therefore not subject to correction by central bank action.
This is the excuses that went on in their heads. This is what they told themselves.
There's a lot of fish, dead fish in this middle.
Yeah, those are all the dead banks.
Oh, I see.
And here's the big banker and the little banker.
And the other side are the golden one.
Right. Do I really want to be responsible for you? Yeah. I'll do the next couple. The free market, okay, the bankers didn't help end the Depression. The free market ideology dominated in the 1920s, which is what we have today. We talk, people talk free market, whatever they mean by it, but basically it's that the government shouldn't regulate business, right? So here's a man and his daughter. Don't worry, it's just the free market economy correcting itself. And this is so true, you know, because the banker will say, oh, we need a correction to, you know. What does that mean? It means people are going to be thrown out of work, you know. And here is the free market fish pond, and the fish is saying, okay, I ate all the little fish, now what? I love these cartoons. I love them. Okay, and the monetary system was inherently unstable. You can talk about all the bankers and what they thought and the mistakes, but the system itself was unstable. The existence of such a financial system is, of course, the ultimate explanation for the financial collapse. It's a fractional reserve system. Lene, do you know what a fractional reserve system is?
Is that what you're talking about, where they create money from, they have, so like, if you have so much money, you can create so much money from that?
Yes, if you have so many reserves from your Federal Reserve Bank, if you have reserves, then you, the commercial bank, can create money out of nothing, so much
right.
money out of nothing.
And but it's like dependent on what some sort of
this
real,
reserve, okay. this reserve from your Federal Reserve Bank.
Yeah, I remember you're talking about.
Yeah, that's what a fractional reserve system is. And
that's when my dad asked me, where does money come from? And I said, well, I said, Sue said it comes out of nowhere.
Right.
And he said, no. That's what I remembered. But yeah.
So, so if I'm the banker and Ann is a borrower, and you come in, how much do you want to borrow?
$100.
So I have an accounting entry, and I put $100 in an accounting entry, my accounting book, and I put it, and I give her a checkbook, and I say, okay, look at your balance, and what's your balance?
And that's $100.
$100, right?
$100, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So I just wrote that in to her checkbook. That's creating it out of nothing. I didn't take it from some other account and move it there. So it's really not correct to say a bank lends, because that implies there's something there that it's giving. It's really a bank creates the loan.
Right, but the fact that it's fractional means that there's some percentage of that money that you're giving away that is it held somewhere.
Well, this I have these reserves. In
but
my
they're
family.
Only a little bitty bit of like
yeah, and reserves are never used for financial transactions by the public. They're just used by the bank in order to create loans.
Yeah, the reserves are never loaned out.
Yeah, yeah. Now, so here's your checking account.
Okay.
Now, you spend it, and you give it to Don. You give him a check.
Yeah.
Okay? Okay, now you're going to pay back. You have to pay me back.
Mm-hmm.
So you work really hard, 2-3 jobs,
right.
And now you're going to pay it back to me. Okay,
mm-hmm.
It disappears. It doesn't exist anymore.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way the system works.
You have to pay interest too.
Yeah, I would have owned you interest. Owed you.
Right. Well, you have to work for that.
Yeah.
And in the Great Depression, as people couldn't pay their loans, suddenly people couldn't pay back their loans to the bank. Suddenly that money disappeared once it's a bad loan. That, so that's the 1/3 of the whole money supply going away, just, you know, escalating more and more.
Of course, they could, if it was a mortgage, you know, a lot of people lost their homes because they couldn't pay the mortgage payments. Then the bank gets the house.
Yes.
But they probably couldn't sell the house anyway.
My father bought the house. He grew up in Manhasset. it had failed. The owner had failed, and he got it for $5,000.
It was like a short sale.
Yeah.
Did he buy it from the bank?
Yeah.
There you go.
The bank sold it at for much less than cost to build.
Yeah.
Back in 28.
But what do they care? Because the bank got it for nothing. They just created the money for the original loan out of nothing. So.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's why when the 2008 crash happened and all those people were foreclosing on their homes, they said, why doesn't Obama just come up with a system where, because the house isn't really worth what they originally bought it for anyway, why don't we just correct in our favor and say, okay, this house is worth this much, and then take all their mortgages down by half so people can own their homes and live in their homes and the banks can still continue having something coming in.
You're fired.
And then it took, you know, he just sat on his butt and didn't do anything and all these people lost all their homes.
Oh, yeah.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Nobody wins in that situation. Everybody loses because the bank loses. I mean, the bank never really had anything anyway, but they would win out more if they were getting a monthly payment, right? Payment.
Yeah.
There's a big plan going on.
Then they'd be helping people.
Right.
So, let's see. An active, vigorous, self-confident policy in the 1920s was followed by a passive, defensive, hesitant policy from 1929 to 1933. The system failed to meet an internal drain in the way intended by its founders. The system was supposed to be the bank of last resort, you know, the lender of last resort. Didn't do anything. Until 1928, the New York Bank was the prime mover in Federal Reserve policy at home and abroad, and Benjamin Strong, its governor from its inception, the president of the New York Bank, was the dominant figure in the Federal Reserve system. Upon his death in 1928, power shifted within the system to those with a lack of understanding and experience. Yeah.
Too bad.
I know.
Oh, he was terrible. Benjamin Strong encouraged the expansion and then sudden contraction to help England with, what's the guy's name? Montagu Norman.
Head of the Bank of England.
Yeah.
Help
England out of trouble.
Yeah.
Well, I think you should time travel back and straighten it all out and prevent the Great Depression.
Take a lot to straighten it out, I tell you. I mean, this is a whole ideology, you know. Martin.
Okay, reactions again, this time the silent economists. Hang on just a minute. Get that out of the way. Okay. One can read through the annual proceedings of the American Economic Association or of the Academy of Political Science and find only occasional sign the academic world even knew about the unprecedented banking collapse in progress, let alone that it understood the cause and the remedy. That's Friedman and Schwartz again, page 115.
How could they be so unaware?
I know. Yeah.
How?
And it looks as though we have a fox over there, and there we have a chicken. The fox is the banking crisis, and the chicken are the economists. And I guess the economists are about to get eaten or something.
They're totally oblivious.
They're clueless.
They're about to be attacked.
Yeah. Okay,
and
again,
the vultures are important.
Oh, yeah, they're
vultures.
Yeah. They're circling around them.
And Friedman and Schwartz, page 115. That climate of intellectual opinion helps to explain why the behavior of the Federal Reserve System from 1929 to 1933 was not checked or reversed by vigorous and informed outside criticism, because it just wasn't there.
Exactly. Exactly. No feedback. Hey, guys, get off your asses. Yeah. And
in January 1931, Congressman A.J. Sabbath asked the Fed to be the lender of last resort and relax discount window requirements.
Meaning, that means allow more loans, give mm-hmm. more loans to the banks.
Oh, this is, I'm sorry, but some congressman understood. Yeah. Congressman A.J. Sabbath of Illinois wrote to Eugene Meyer in January 1931, "Does the board maintain that there is no emergency existing at this time? To my mind, if ever there is an emergency, it is now, and this, I feel, no one can successfully deny. For while 439 banks closed their doors in 1929, during the year 1930, 934 banks were forced to suspend business." On the floor of the House, Sabbath said, "I insist it is within the power of the Federal Reserve Board to relieve the financial and commercial distress." That's Adolph Joachim Sabbath.
Joachim?
Yeah.
Joachim.
Where do you think he's from? German?
Adolf.
I don't know.
That's a
Portuguese.
Wow. But Sabbath, yeah.
Joaquin can be anything.
I think he was from Illinois or Midwest.
The Spanish use it, and, you know, we have an actor.
I can actually just Google.
Yeah.
I'm just going to Google it. I'm like, I just
yeah,
find
sure.
it, and then you know, yeah, figure out where his roots are from.
So he was very clear. Wait a minute. We have a major crisis here. Do something. It's an emergency.
I mean, it sounds like a German name, the Adolf.
Adolf does, yeah.
Yeah.
Or Polish.
He's from Slovakia.
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 Mm. Yeah, Slovakia.
Linnea, yes, yeah, your turn.
Continuing with some economists understood, Irving Fisher. Overinvestment and overspeculation are often important, but they would have far less serious results were they not conducted with borrowed money. If debt and deflation are absent, other disturbances are powerless to bring on crises comparable in severity to those of 1837, 1773, or 29-33. Irving Fisher, The Debt Deflation Theory of the Great Depression, page 9. Our national circulating medium, the money we use, is now at the mercy of loan transactions of banks. What makes the trouble is the fact that the bank lends not money, but merely a promise to furnish money on demand, money it does not possess. Irving Fisher, The Debt Deflation Theory of Great Depression, is originally published in 1933.
So he understood the debt money system. He understood why it was so threatening to the stability of our economy and was causing the Great Depression. He understood that. he followed the money. He understood what money was. Let me do this one, Don, and then, okay. So here is a flow of what Irving Fisher has in his book, The Debt Deflation Theory of Great Depression. So he says, you have over-indebtedness, you know, like stock market, everyone buying stocks, everyone buying houses, the farmers buying farms, everyone's buying. Okay? And he calls that the debt disease. You know? And of course it's under the control of the banks who decide if they're going to give the loans and to whom, right? And then this, it becomes more and more big bubbles of debt, and then there's an alarm of either the debtors or the creditors, either one, right? So in an effort to lessen their debt, the debtors will sell off their stocks or whatever to get money, right? I don't want to, you know, I'm going to have less debt. And, or the creditors would sell off their stocks, and the debtors would try to pay back their loans, right? And if they had stocks, they try to sell them. You know, everyone's trying to sell stocks to get money to pay off their loans. And so that would contract deposits and contract the amount of money in the society. And there's this alarm where people say, okay, maybe I won't take that vacation this year. I'm just going to wait and see what happens. You know, my job's a little shaky, blah, 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 blah. So all of that is the debt disease, and that was the stock market. The ultimate of it was the stock market crash, right, where everyone just panicked, right? Then if you contract deposits and the stock of money in the banks and the amount of money that people are spending, and if you sell off all the stocks and bonds very quickly and depress the price of everything, the price level goes down. You have less money, right? You have too many stocks running after that money. Mm-hmm. And that he called the dollar disease, when the prices get depressed. Because when the price gets depressed, all of the rest of this stuff happens. The falling prices precipitates the fall in profits or bankruptcies, which causes reduction in output and employment, which leads to loss of confidence, which leads to hoarding, and it just goes on and on and on and on. So what Irving Fisher said is, okay, if you have this huge bubble of debt and there's a panic, the first thing you want to do is not do something so at least the prices don't fall, because then at least the employment will stay up. Mm-hmm. People won't lose their jobs. But in the Great Depression, both of these happened without anybody doing anything. This is what's his theory. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it started with the monetary system, with the creation of all those loans. So here's Fisher, this is from his book. It is always economically possible to stop or prevent such a depression simply by reflating the price level. In fact, under President Hoover, recovery was apparently well started by the Federal Reserve open market purchases, which revived prices and business from May to September 1932. The efforts were not kept up, and recovery was stopped.
Wow.
Yeah. And here's the other thing he said I picked out of the book. It would have been still easier to have prevented the depression had his Governor Strong, the president of the New York Fed, who died in 1928, if Governor Strong policies had been embraced, there would have been nothing worse than the first crash. This would be the only thing, Fisher said, this is the only thing that would happen.
Yeah.
He said, we would have had the debt disease, but not the dollar disease, the bad cold, but not the pneumonia. You know. Because if at this point the Federal Reserve banks come in and create the reserves for their banks, mm-hmm. you know, and it would just restore the confidence of the bankers, you know, and then they would keep giving out the loans, so that business wouldn't start to fail, and the prices decline. But that didn't happen. Don, you do this one.
Reactions. The pushing on a string argument. Apology for the bankers. There was a widespread belief that just making reserves available in banks would not solve the problem because businessmen couldn't be forced to borrow in such bad times. The banker says no good loans to be made, no loan demand. One, what was it? One, three, push. I don't understand.
You see the string?
Yes, slap.
And you're going to push the string. So that this is the banker's belief that, well, even if we have all these reserves and we can make all these loans, no one is going to want them.
Yeah.
It would be like pushing on a string.
Yeah.
That's their belief.
So Zonenger said we can rephrase their argument that the destruction created by the bankers made businessmen overly cautious.
Right. So the bankers are saying no businessman's going to borrow from us anyway. Mm-hmm. That's their attitude. Martin, do the next one.
I think he's busy.
Martin? Oh, yeah, look. Let's see. Martin? Maybe he's offline.
Yeah.
Oh, no, he's moving.
Okay. However, the study, 1935 study of C.C. Hardy and Jacob Viner, showed there was loan demand. That's Zolenga, Lost Science of Money, page 550. There exists a genuine unsatisfied demand for credit on the part of solvent borrowers, that one of the most serious aspects of this unsatisfied demand is the pressure for liquidation of old working capital loans, even sound ones. That this pressure is partly due to a determination on the part of the bankers to avoid a recurrence of the errors to which they attribute much of their responsibility for the recent wave of bank failures. That was the report on the availability of bank credit in the 7th Federal Reserve District submitted to the Secretary of the Treasury, GPO, 1935, pages Roman numeral 6 and then 3. Let's see. Hang on just a minute. Okay, there we go. The bankers were not trying to make loans and were calling in existing good loans. The banking system confused credit with money, used the credit to fuel a speculative bubble, and broke down when a panic set in. The bankers were scared to death. The fractional reserve system had lost the confidence of the depositors. And over there on the left, there's something that says banker. I don't think my Microsoft Office is displaying this correctly. I think there's something that's not displaying.
He's in the hospital bed, scared shitless.
Oh, okay. Thank you. I don't see that on my screen, but yeah, it's great.
So the bankers were scared. They were totally scared. They had caused this debacle. And they were part of this system that was falling apart all around them, and they knew that they didn't have enough money in their bank to pay their depositors. Mm-hmm. But this Hardy and Viner study showed that there were people that could have good credit and wanted loans.
Yeah.
They wanted them. You know, and the bankers were calling in perfectly valid loans because they were so scared. You know, they were demanding you pay it now. You know, and causing problems doing that. So it was crazy back then. You know.
Hey Sue, I've got to do something real quickly. So just continue without me. I'll be back.
Okay. Oops. And when
cartoon.
Oh, okay.
I know.
Following Adam Smith to the doors of hell. Adam Smith's free market thinking dominated the 1920s. Government should not interfere with the laws of supply and demand. Here is a reaction of a Federal Reserve banker to the New York Federal Bank suggesting open market buying of government securities to relieve the credit situation. July 10th, that should be 1930.
Yeah.
James McDougall of the Chicago Fed to Harrison, New York Fed. It seemed to him that there was an abundance of funds in the market, and under these circumstances, as a matter of prudence, it should be the policy of the Federal Reserve System to maintain a position of strength in readiness to meet future demands, rather than to put reserve funds into the market when not needed. Speculation might easily arise in some other direction than the stock market. So we have here James McDougall, first governor of the Chicago Fed Bank, 1914 to 1934. George L. Harrison, second governor, New York Fed Bank, 1928 to 1940. And these two characters. There it is again, the invisible hand of the marketplace giving us the finger.
You know, the economist has this theory, yeah. You know, free market theory. Just leave everything alone.
Don't regulate.
And everybody will get their needs met.
That's
really.
Current thinking also, right?
Yes. We've gone back to that thinking.
Yeah.
The Depression caused people to say no. And then we've forgotten what we learned. We've gone back to it. You know. Nobody wants to look at the money system. That was the cause of this.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't want us to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
It's crazy.
Yeah, it is crazy. Linnea.
Okay, following Adam Smith's The Door of the Pill. Adam Smith's free market thinking dominated the 20s. The government should not interfere with the laws of supply and demand. Sorry, other Fed bankers. From John Hulkins of San Francisco Fed, 1930, June. He writes, with credit cheap and redundant, we do not believe that business recovery will be accelerated by making credit cheaper and more redundant. And then Lynn P. Talley of the Fed says in July of that same year, not inclined to countenance much interference with economic trends through artificial methods.
Nothing artificial with that around here.
W.G. Geary of Minneapolis says, there is no danger of stimulating...
No, there is danger.
There is danger. Oh, there is danger of stimulating financing, which will lead to still more overproduction.
the problem is really
overproduction. Yeah. And then Norris of Philadelphia Fed says in September of that same year, the Philadelphia Bank objected to the present abnormally low rates for money as an interference with the operation of the natural law of supply and demand in the money market. And then the little comic strip says, corporate leaders gather in a field outside Darien, Connecticut, where one of them claims to have seen the invisible hand of the marketplace. Sightings of the invisible hand.
The invisible hand. Oh.
Don,
do the next one.
Adam Smith's false economic concepts were dangerous to the nation. Herbert Hoover believed orthodox economic theory, cut spending, balance the budget, but he made it worse. Hoover ran federal budget surpluses through 1931. He put through a major tax increase in 1932. Wow! He sent Federal Reserve workers home one day a week to save money. But meanwhile, the need was for more money. Bank reserves and deposits were crashing, the money supply disappearing, and the sovereign responsibility of our government is to ensure enough money so people can survive and live decent lives and the economy generate support for all the people. And the lady says, I have the invisible hand of the market on line two. Should I put it through? It's time to balance the budget. It's really dumb.
This is what gets taught at school. Robert DeFremery, he's a monetary reformer, he wrote Money and Freedom. He said, the orthodox banking theorists took the stand that a liquidation of bank credit, meaning debt going away, either paying it off or failing to pay it off but disappearing, would be a wholesome thing But obviously a contraction of the supply of money is not a wholesome thing in terms of the effect it has on human beings. That's the way they talk. They say, oh, let's get rid of this debt. You know, then we'll start fresh. But meanwhile, to get rid of the debt means to get rid of people's money, which means their livelihoods, you know. Bernard Baruch advised President Roosevelt to balance the budget and let nature take its course. They love to say that. Let's have nature take its course and get rid of all this debt, right? Roosevelt fortunately did not take Baruch's advice. And this is, we could stop here. This is the third banking crisis, and this is where Roosevelt has his holiday. You know, because this was.
So you're saying, though, with the two slide that you just read, that the elimination of all of the debt to start from a clean plate is actually not the way to go.
Because it removes money from circulation.
Because the debt is the money. That's what.
Right.
Yeah. So if you remove the debt, there's no money.
Yeah.
That's why the system itself is such a catch-22. It's so awful.
Yeah.
We all have to be in debt in order to have a money supply. It's crazy.
Yeah, it is crazy. And all of these supposedly brilliant people...
They're not interested in anything else.
...couldn't figure it out.
Most of them went through, you know, very orthodox training.
Yeah.
I mean, look at the MBAs today that go through. Mm-hmm. They think the same way. Mm-hmm. You know?